All right, so we have one item to wrap up from Perek Yudchet, from chapter 18. We identified the Levi, who was, you know, sort of the engine in this whole story of Micha's idol. He was the one who first served Micha and then met people from Dan, and then they came back and they kidnapped him and he became the priest for them. We identified him as Moshe's grandson, right? He was listed as Yehonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe with that odd placement of the Nun. And last time we read through that long Gemara in Bava Basra, which seizes on the small bits of evidence that we have here. Number one, the odd, is it Menashe or is it Moshe? The fact that we listed three generations for someone who didn't seem to be worthy of celebrity at all. The fact that Gershom ben Menashe is somebody who is known to us, and in fact, later on we find somebody else, Shvuel, who is the son of Gershom ben Menashe, plus the fact that we threw in his name in the story, but we did it at the end, put together all of these different pieces, and came up with the idea that this is actually Moshe's grandson, and that this the story only includes his identity at the end, and does it in this veiled way, in order to protect Moshe, that we shouldn't know that his grandson ended up with this very odd career path, which leads him into either syncretism or Avodah Zarah. Ricky, yes.
What makes this story important enough to be in? To be actually put down on paper is that there were so many things that were going on at the same time. Why was that story chosen?
Right. So the story of Pesel Micha, the whole story of the idol of Micha, we mentioned back when we began the story. You weren't here yet. A few weeks ago, but we talked about the idea that this demonstrates more so than some of the other stories. Number one, what happens when we lack a leader, which is going to set the stage for the monarchy, which will begin in the next book of Shmuel. It also shows how the Jews have become like the Canaanim around them in the syncretism, the adoption of this type of worship. And so that's another major reason for this story to be included here. And it's even moved to the end, because as we said, most authorities assume, and from the stories, from elements of the text itself, that this story occurred earlier. But it's moved to the end of the book, setting the table for Sefer Shmuel, for the book of Shmuel, which is next. And we're going to talk more about that when we start the next story, actually, the last one in the book, of Pilegish Begivah. But along the lines of what Ricky asked, I want to ask, what happened here at the end with Moshe's grandson? Meaning, you tell me that you want to protect Moshe's dignity, right? So we're going to be clever, and we'll put a sort of half nun in the name, and it's not going to say Moshe, now it'll say Menashe. If you wanted to protect Moshe, just don't put it in Tanakh. And if Tanakh, for some reason, needs to say it, then why does the Gemara need to go through this whole long discussion about it? You know, if this is meant to be kept quiet, then let's keep it quiet. Why are we playing this game of divulging this? What is it that we're supposed to learn here? Not to mention the overall question of, really, how does this happen to Moshe's grandson? Right? The Gemara gave us, gave us one answer, right? By saying that, well, Moshe had said, if you need a parnasa, you should go get a job. You should find work, even work that is zara to you, even work that is foreign to you, you should do. And he misunderstood. Ha, what a joke. He thought he meant even avodah zara, even idolatry. So, you know, while it's an interesting explanation with lessons regarding, getting a job, nonetheless, it's missing something in terms of explaining that Moshe's grandson ends up with idolatry. It's just so strange.
Is the timeline, like in terms of years, does that even make sense if we go back?
Yes, because assuming this story is where most of the commentators put it, the Jews have only been in Israel for about 30 years.
Oh, okay.
Moshe only died 30 years before this, so that his grandson could be engaged in this is certainly possible. So, you could give quite a few different answers. One answer would be, I'm not giving this as a serious answer, but I think it's something that people should still think about in and of itself. Where were Gershom and his brother, who's Moses' other son?
Eliezer,
right? Gershom and Eliezer, where are they when the Torah is given?
In Midian.
Quite possibly in Midian. Depends how you read the beginning of Parshas Yisro. Parshas Yisro starts out with Yisro coming to Moshe along with Tzipora and along with Moshe's two sons, right? Because Moshe had not taken them to Mitzrayim, right? That's the story there. The question is, when does the beginning of Parshas Yisro happen? And that's a machlokas. One view is that that story happens where it appears in the Torah, which is to say, the Jews have just fought their war with Amalek, right? They have not yet arrived at Sinai. And then after this story, they come to Sinai and then they get the Torah, in which case the family is all together when the Torah is given. However, that chronology is difficult to sustain. For starters, because in this story, Moshe is spending all day judging the people. Right? Moshe spends the entire day judging the people, hearing cases, and Yisro says to him, what are you doing? It's not good for you, and so on. If they don't have a Torah yet, what is he judging them with? What is he doing? What's the din that's described there?
There are rules to be followed when you're in a group.
Who created the rules, and by what rules are they, like, what are they debating? There are other reasons to question the chronology, but the bottom line is, and what I'm trying to show is, that many of the early commentators assume this story actually took place after the Torah was given. There are reasons for it to show up where it does, in the Torah, in the Chumash, but fundamentally it actually occurred later, which means this young man here in our story, right, who comes out, you know, working for the Avodah Zarah, he was certainly not at the giving of the Torah. He's too young. Potentially, I would assume that. Actually, I shouldn't assume that, but it sounds like it. But even his father may not have been at Matan Torah. Now, again, as I said in the beginning, I don't really think that's an explanation for this. Neither were we. This
I
is
was
true.
Just going to say, yeah, that doesn't matter. Not the best word.
No, but I like this as something to think about in general. The idea that Moshe's family isn't at the giving of the Torah at Sinai is something that's worth chewing on for a bit.
Yeah, it's a major life event you want your family
there. Why would you think so.
Not to mention, you know, his dad did good. Like, you'd think he would get to be there for it.
What is your personal favorite interpretation?
Of what?
Of the Moshe's grandson.
Oh, well, I've got a few to offer you. I have a few to offer here. One that I think is a potential idea is the Gemara Nedarim Pei Aleph. Take a look at source number one on your sheet. This is a classic passage of Gemara. Why isn't it common for Torah scholars to have Torah scholars among their children? Yeah, last time somebody said, you know, don't you have these dynasties? But the truth of the matter is, you don't always have these dynasties. And it's more common that you don't have them. Not necessarily that the parents are very committed and the children have no commitment, but that, you know, they go off and do something else. They're not going to pursue, so to speak, the family business. When I first became a rabbi, people in the community would always, when I became a shul rabbi, would always ask me, so is your father a rabbi also? And I would always tell them, there hasn't been a rabbi Torchiner since, as far as we know, the 17th century. It's just not there. And people were surprised. Like, they just assume that it sort of runs in the family. Well, that's exactly what Rav Yosef says. Rav Yosef says, you know why it doesn't happen? Shelo yomru Torah Yerusha Yilahem. So that people should not say that Torah is an inheritance. You know, there are people who are in, I don't know, scrap metal, and there are people who are in diamonds, and then there are people who are in Torah. And so that family, they're the Torah family. You know, and that family, they have another business or whatever. You know, and that's counterproductive. Right? Even though we do say, Marashaki Ilas Yaakov, right? It is supposed to be passed on in the family of Yaakov. That's the broader family of Yaakov. You don't want a situation in which there are the professional Jews and then there are the amateur Jews. That's not a healthy scenario. So what this Gemara is suggesting, actually, when you think about it, this is a free will problem, is that God is going to manipulate things to avoid dynasties. That's what it's suggesting, right? Why doesn't it happen? happen? Because we don't want people to say that Torah is an inheritance. So Hashem is going to look to sabotage that that line.
There's a difference between
they're not in the family. Rambam, Ramban are not related at all. I mean, all Jews are related in some way.
Oh,
but
yeah, well,
no,
all Jews.
No connection.
It's a difference if the child is not a Torah scholar, is not a rabbi or a leader, then if they go and perform Avodah Zarah. I mean, it's not the same thing.
Right. Not being a doesn't mean that you have to work at McDonald's. Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, this is true. This is true. Right. Or eat a McDonald's. It's a better analogy. They,
No, aren't there the Hasidic diets?
I mean, there are. There certainly are, and the Hasidim promote it.
Yeah.
You know, that's for sure true. And the truth is that the Rambam had a son, Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam, who was a great leader in his own right. It's not, you know, I shouldn't say there was no line there. But that's what the Gemara is observing, that it doesn't get passed on. Now, the Gemara gives other reasons as well.
Yeah.
Although it's harder to apply the other reasons to Moshe. Rav Sheshes Breder of Edi Omer Kedei Shelo Yizgadru Al HaTzibur. He says it's so that people will not, this dynasty will not lord it over the community. In other words, look at us, we're teachers of Torah and we're above everybody else. Marzutra says, it's the opposite. Marzutra Omer V'pnei Shehein Mizgabrin Al HaTzibur. It's because they lord it over the community. It's a punishment. And then Rav Ashi Omer Mishum Dekaru Le'inshi Chamri. Rav Ashi says it's because they call people donkeys, meaning they don't respect the community adequately. If it becomes like we're the people of Torah and the community is not, then there develops an arrogance develops. Exactly. Ravina Omer She'ein Mevarchen BaTorah Tchila, because they don't recite the bracha before studying Torah. What's that about?
Yeah.
There's another Gemara which talks about the Beis Hamikdash being destroyed because people did not recite the bracha before studying Torah. The bracha before studying Torah is usually said in the morning, and it covers your whole day. But what's the connection? What's the point of having a bracha on studying Torah?
So you appreciate
it.
To
appreciate it, right? Like we do bracha, like we do brachas on other things.
To focus on it and to get some kind of a connection.
To focus and get some kind of a connection. So keep in mind, we have different kinds of brachos. Right? There is Berchas Hanenin, the bracha on something you enjoy. A person is going to take a piece of melon and they're going to make a bracha on it beforehand. That's Berchas Hanenin. There is Berchas HaShevach, a bracha of praise to God when you perceive something that you want to praise. The rainbow bracha is a good question in terms of where it fits in. It's not so clear. There are certain brachos that are hard to categorize. And Berchas HaTorah is actually one of them. But I'm going to present Berchas HaTorah as Berchas HaMitzvah. Birchas HaMitzvah, it's not a bracha of I enjoy learning Torah and so I'm going to thank God for it. It's a bracha on the mitzvah of Torah study. Parenthetically, it's one of only two brachos, there may be a third, but basically only two brachos that are de'oraisa, that are biblically mandated. Right? What's the other one? The other one is the more commonly known one. That's a biblically mandated bracha. You shall eat, you shall be full, you shall bless, berkat hamazon. Blessing after eating. That's the other one. But this is also, because in Parshas Ha'azinu, Moshe says, Ki shem Hashem ekra, when I declare the name of God, havugod elokeinu, you shall bless God, you shall exalt God. And from that we understand that there is a mitzvah of when someone declares the name of God, meaning reciting from the Torah, there should be a bracha associated with it. But in terms of what they're trying to say here, I think it's the idea that this is a bracha on a mitzvah that's really important. Because what does it do when you make a bracha on a mitzvah? What's the difference between doing a mitzvah without a bracha and doing a mitzvah with a bracha? Let's say you pick up the lulav. What's the difference between picking up the lulav and, you know, waving it around and all that without a bracha versus doing it with the bracha?
What makes us think about
meaning to your heart and your
God told you to do it?
It's an obligation. Recognizes that God told you to do it, feel an obligation, and it makes it more meaningful. What do you mean?
Well,
blessing what you're going to do.
Right. It means that you declare it to be a mitzvah. Right? There are all sorts of things that I do in the course of the day. Some of them are good things. Some of them may be value neutral. Hopefully not too many of them are bad. But I do them because I want to. When a person recites a blessing and says, "Thank you, God, you sanctified us with your commandments and instructed us to do," fill in the blank, pick up the lulav, learn Torah, whatever it is. At that point, what they're saying is, what I'm doing is not just an intellectual pursuit. What I'm doing is a religious activity. It's my relationship with God. No more so than in Torah. Because Torah can be an intellectual pursuit. Right? It could be. I had a Rebbe in grade 9 who used to talk about people who study Torah, and it's Talmud 101. You know, it could be a university course, and it has no religious significance to it at all. It's simply academic curiosity that motivates me to learn it. And no surprise, he was not a fan. But that's exactly the point. Take a look now, back in source number 1, Ravina is warning. He says, if they don't recite the bracha, the blessing, before studying Torah, what that means is that Torah is an intellectual thing. And they may be scholars, but their kids aren't going to be interested in following it. You know, if they live it, if they're invested in it, if there's an emotional attachment to it, then their kids may see that and say, you know, that's beautiful, I want that too. If it's just, you know, this is what dad does, right? My father is a mathematician. My father is a marine biologist. So that doesn't mean I'm going to be a marine biologist. Okay, that fascinates him. May not fascinate me.
That's been an argument, a discussion. You know, those courses in universities that are academic and they're not religious or Torah. You know, they're studying Torah, but it's totally academic.
Yeah, but that's...
I'm just mentioning it.
Yeah, no, you're right. So, you know, again, going back to where we were with this, I don't think that the latter answers... Basically, we gave 5 different answers in this Gemara for why Torah scholars will not have descendants who are in that line. I don't think the latter 5 fit the Moshe scenario. I don't think we're particularly concerned about Moshe lording it over the community. I don't think that there's any issue of Moshe calling people donkeys. You know, I'm fairly sure that Moshe said the bracha before learning Torah, if anybody ever did, given that he's the one who told us that we're supposed to do it. And it's certainly a religious experience, you know, when he studies Torah. But that first one is the issue of how people respond. Less people say Torah is an inheritance. So that could be an answer. I haven't seen anyone suggest it, but I think that the association is natural. Alternatively, you know, so we have 3 answers so far, right? We have the answer of the Gemara that it's economic privation. He was starving and he misunderstood what the advice was that he had received. We have the second answer that, well, you know, his father wasn't at the presentation of the Torah and maybe that somehow led to something, which again, I just mentioned it as something of interest. Third approach would be from this Gemara that it's meant to show Torah is not an inheritance. All of these are just, you know, well, the first one is the Gemara, the other two are my own thought, but the fourth one, and last one that I'll suggest, comes from a Midrash, which I found the Gemara and the Dharam interesting, and I really like that passage, but this one I heard a Rama at Karen Biavna speak about it. This is now 26 years ago, and it's stuck in my head ever since. So when we hit this, I said, oh, now is my time to use it. This is, for those who know, Reb Blachman at Karen Biavna, he talked about this at a Friday night tish, and when you see this Midrash, you'll understand why. Moshe says that he was a foreigner, Be'eretz Nochriya, in a foreign land. Right? He was a stranger in a foreign land. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Eretz Nochriya Haisalo Vadai. Rabbi Yeshua says it certainly was a foreign land to him. Okay. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you know, what's the foreign land?
The land of Yitro was.
Midian. Where Yitro is, right. Yeah. Moshe's from Egypt. In some sense, he knows he's a Hebrew. Midian is Eretz Nochriya. Rabbi Elazar Hamodoi, Omer be'Eretz Nochriya, and then he breaks it down, the word Nochriya, Nechar Ka. Nechar means?
Strange.
Foreign, right? In Talmudic Hebrew, very often, a non-Jew is a Nochri. You know, somebody from the outside, not part of the family. Nechar Ka a strange god, land of a foreign god. And now the Midrash explains the concept. When Moshe said to his father of his soon-to-be father-in-law, Yisro, give me your daughter Tzipora as a wife, Omar lo Yisro, Yisro said, maybe. He said, if you will accept this one request I'm going to make of you, then you can marry my daughter. Omar lo ma'u. He said, what do you want? Omar lo ben sheyi alachatchila yiyela avodazara. Your first son has to go for idolatry. Mikan ve'elach l'shem shemayim. And afterward, any of them can be for God. That's fine. That's Yisro's demand of Moshe. Ve'kibel olav. And Moshe said, deal. Does that fit at all with anything you ever understood about Moshe?
Wait, he didn't even speak to God yet, did he?
At that point, he has not spoken to God
yet. Why? What's the big deal?
Because I think idolatry still mattered.
But he came from the land of Egypt. He grew up in Egypt. They had idolatry. He had to
There were Jews
in Egypt who did worship Avodah Zarah. Who did worship idols. Yeah, Yechezkel talks about it.
He didn't take upon anything with God yet at this point.
It doesn't trouble you at all?
But it's true,
at this point in his life, he has any defense that the Hebrews were, you know, you could feel bad for someone and defend them. I mean, that's your belief. I don't know, I'm just saying it's not. It feels so strongly about it at this point.
Where
is Yitro coming with that?
So that's the other question, Yisro.
Yeah. But just the fact that he says that to him, it means that he's aware that Moshe is not into Avodah Zarah.
That's true. Yeah. Otherwise, why would he make him agree? That's a good point.
Is it a task not to just say yes or no?
Right, so Roberta says maybe this is a test, and Moshe fails the test then.
No,
he said yes.
He didn't say yes.
But he married her anyway.
Why would Yitro be saying that? Because, like, when did his...
Yeah, I mean, Yitro was identified. Right. Yisro is an interesting story in his own right, because Yisro was introduced to us in the Torah as Kohen Midian, the priest of Midian. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, his daughters go to the well and they get harassed. Right? If he's really their priest, why are people harassing his daughters at the well? Which leads the Midrash to conclude that Yisro had been Kohen Midian and he had left it. He was once the priest of Avodah Zarah, and he walked away, which just makes this even more perplexing. You know, why would the priest who walked away be the one to demand that that Moshe try this?
Is this in the Torah that Yitro said that to him?
Right. So this is all based on the psukim that the Medrash brings to support it, but nowhere will it be explicitly in the Torah.
Somebody made this up.
No, this is what you call drash, meaning when you have a pasuk, and this is making the long story short because I could spend the entire time on this point, but people are fond of reading a sentence in Chumash or reading a sentence in the Navi and saying, here's my dictionary, I can translate each of the words, and that's what the sentence means, and I'll call it pshat. However, if you do that, you run the risk of missing everything going on in the sentence, because sentences will have nuances in terms of word choice. Sentences will have grammatic anomalies. Sentences will have other references elsewhere in Tanakh, which if the reader is familiar with them, they'll say, oh, wait a minute, there's another message that I'm supposed to get here. It's not only about taking my dictionary and saying, this word means this, this word means this. There's a whole other realm, and that's where drash comes in. It's the ear of the rabbis who are the authors of the Midrash to say, that extra letter, or that choice of words, or that reference which fits something else, that's giving me the following lesson. So in this case, for example, they pick up on the fact that when Moshe names his son, at the naming of his son, he says, I was a stranger in a foreign land. And they're bothered by that. The word nochriya, they're bothered by. They're bothered because he already said he's a ger. He already said he's a stranger. Right? I already know that. They're bothered by it because he's not a stranger there anymore. How long has he been living in Midian by this time?
He already has a
Huh. Oh, more than a few years. Moshe's been living, we know how long he's been living there. Tell me something. When they're supposed to go to, when he's supposed to go back to Egypt, when he's supposed to go back to Egypt and he doesn't give his son the bris milah, that whole story, right? Moshe's 80 years old. Midrash believes that it only says that Vayigdal Ha'ish, before he left Egypt, we don't know precise age. One view is he's 13, another view is he's 20. He's been in Midian longer than he was in Egypt, and not by like a short margin. This is not a strange land. Sorry?
And only then did he have his
kids? And only then does he have his kids. His kids seem to come together at the end. I can't prove to you that they're actually that close in age. But that's the way they're presented together in the psukim, when it says, and then there's this one, and then there's this one. And he's a small child, small enough that Moshe has to put him onto the donkey when he's riding off to Egypt, and then Aaron has to say, you know what, leave them there in Midian. Don't bring them to Egypt. If it was his son, who was now 50, 60 years old, there'd be no reason he couldn't come along. That was 80-year-old father. I think that's part of what the Midrash is picking up on. I could read the sentence and just say, stranger in a foreign land, but I'd be missing what the rabbis of the Midrash are picking up on. And they say, you know what? Nochriya doesn't mean the land is foreign. Nochriya, Nechar, Ya, the god of this land is foreign, and somehow that's associated with this kid who has been born, and that's part of what they pick up on, but frankly, what the Midrash is also picking up on is our story, right here, that Gershom's son becomes a priest for Avodah Zarah. And they're saying, here's your missing link. It's the deal with Yisro. There's more to be said about this, but let's go through the Midrash and then come back. So he says to him, Amar lo hishavali. Yisro says, I want you to swear to me. Vayishavalo, and Moshe swore to Yisro, Shneamar, Vayoel Moshe, and here they're picking up on another aspect of the pasuk that's strange. Moshe says to Yisro, and Moshe marries the daughter of Yisro, and it says, Vayoel Moshe, Lasheves Es Ha'ish. The word Vayoel is a strange word.
I just want to say, what does it mean?
What does it mean? We actually saw the word Vayoel in our story. Go back to the Levi's encounter with Micha in chapter 17, sentence 11.
You need a concordance for that.
But they had it in their head. That's the thing. Vayoel ha-Levi la-Sheves es ha-Ish. The Levi, again, Vayoel, to stay with the man. That's another reason why we associate him with Moshe, is because you see the shared language, and it's an odd word. This is not a word that shows up on every page. So what it means, usually we render it as, he agreed to, he was convinced, he was persuaded to do something. Hinei naho alti, is Abraham talking to God? Whatever, let me not go too far with it. The point is, look what the Medrash does. Vayoel, it links to the root, Allah, Aleph Lamed Hey. And Aleph Lamed Hey, that's a language we do know. It means an oath. Ein Allah, Lashon Shavuas. They say Moshe had to swear something to Yisro. What was it he had to swear to? This deal. There's more in the Midrash. I didn't bring you the entire thing. L'fichach ikdim ha-malach la-haroges Moshe. And that, he says, is why the Malach wants to kill Moshe. The famous story that no one can understand of what, you know, God sends Moshe to Egypt and then he wants to send the Malach to kill Moshe. You know, even if he's not doing the bris milah for his son, like, where is the death penalty for it, and then who's going to take the Jews out of Egypt? So this Midrash says, no, the Malach is angry at Moshe because of what he did with Gershom. When he said,
This is the same son.
Well, that's the question is always, is it Gershom or is it Eliezer? It sounds like it should be Eliezer. But this Midrash seems to think it's Gershom. Gershom is the older.
The first one gives to...
Correct. Now, the problem is that we believe he has two sons by the time he goes to Egypt. He can't possibly have one that's younger than an 8-day-old kid.
No, I realize that, but it was the first one that was supposed to be given to idolatry.
Correct. But here it's saying that the Malach wants to kill Moshe because of Gershom. But the Malach waits then. Because at this point he already has another son. Why didn't he do it right after Moshe agreed to this, or after he did this with Gershom? That's not... I agree with the question. In the psukim themselves, it doesn't say which son is getting the bris.
unless they he promised that if the first one's Togo Zephra, and along comes the second one, and the eighth day comes along, and he hasn't done it, so they think that he'd be nagging going to
that's
the
an interesting
second
idea.
One Togo Zephra, so that's all he attacked.
I don't know. I don't know, but the question is, why does Yisrael want this, and why does Moshe go along with it? So there are, of course, many approaches to this. Rav Tzedakah Cohen in his Pri Tzadik has a nice discussion of this, but what Rav Bachman said at the time in Keren Biavne was, Yisrael is a seeker of truth. Yisrael always looks for that which is true. That's his personality, and that's why he leaves being Kohen Midyan. He's top of the world. He's the priest of Midyan. He is set for life. They'll give him wealth, they'll give him whatever he wants, social standing, and he walks away because he says, well, this isn't real, this isn't true. Right? Like the beginning of Parshas Yisro says, by Yishma Yisro, Yisro heard what had happened, and he heard about the Nisim, the miracles that had happened for the Jews, and he's so impressed. Yisro is somebody who goes looking for truth. And Yisro wants his grandson to be a seeker as well. He's worried that if you're Moshe's kid, you take religion for granted. Right? Well, look, my father spoke to God face to face. Right? I mean, you know, what else am I going to do in my life?
By that time he hasn't spoken to that. Or by that time he has.
Right, so at that point, no, technically, you're right, at this point he hasn't. Fair enough. Nonetheless, he's worried, even still, he's worried that Moshe's son is going to be a Jew, and that's going to be that. He won't have done this type of searching that Yisro personally
wants
did.
To come, maybe he wants to come to Moshe on his own thinking.
Correct.
We know what God did Midian bring.
The Midianite god, so later on we find them associated with Chemosh, even though Chemosh is a god of Moab. Seems to remember, no, Amon is the one I'm thinking of. Amon has Malcolm as a god. They have Baal Peor later on in Chumash, right? Right before in Parshas Balak and the end of Parshas Balak, right? The daughters of Midian and Moab, they take, or daughters of Midian principally, get the Jews to worship Peor. So they're worshiping some version of the Baal, basically.
Okay, so Yitro, that was the Parsha, unless I'm wrong, where the Eser Hadibot is given.
That's
right?
The one.
So if we're associating him with Avodah Zarah and everything like that, and encouraging Moshe to encourage his son to do Avodah Zarah, they don't have a problem with Yisro Hadibot.
So,
I'm
going to give a brutal answer. I'm going to give a brutal answer. I ask for forgiveness in advance from all those who have ever heard and liked or given a Divrei Torah about how a parsha is named for a particular person, and therefore it tells us the names of the parshios are simply good, mnemonics pulled from the opening sentence or two sentences of the parsha. Because if we were really going to do that, we would have to ask how it is that Balak, king of Moab, gets a parsha named for him. And there is no parsha with Moshe. You know, there's no parshas Moshe, there's no parshas Abraham, and so on. The truth of the matter is that's my belief, and I apologize because there are some beautiful Divrei Torah related to things like that. I'm sorry. But the answer could be, if we want to salvage it, that we don't believe that Yisro is inherently wrong. In other words, being a seeker of truth is important. It's important that we not simply accept things and go along with them. There's a real danger in that. We lose the meaning. We lose what the significance is of what we're doing, and it just becomes rote, right? What we call mitzvah danashim melum mada, that which people are just trained to do, and they do it because this is, you know, what I've developed as a habit.
So we haven't come to the truth that God was...
No, he did. Yisro had come to that truth, but he wants his grandson to come to that truth on his own. He says, I want my grandson to have a broad education. I want him to have a good liberal arts education. I want him to see all the cultures that are out there, and then let him decide that he wants Judaism. That's what Yisro is promoting.
Being dedicated to
Avodah Zarah. That's the idea. Let him see idolatry.
And then
he'll have the chance to reject that.
Yeah.
Let him come back from that.
Well,
that's
so different.
Why only one?
Maybe he knows Moshe won't go along with it.
But meaning, like, that kid, if he goes for adultery, he's only seeing adultery, not necessarily both.
Yeah, I don't know. Kid. I don't know. Good question. There are multiple questions you could ask about this. It also doesn't sound like he's just being exposed to it. It sounds like, no, like, put him into Avodah Zarah. That's what it sounds like. But the message then of this Midrash and the message of the story here in Shoftim is it's really good for you to go seek truth, but you have to know the hazards that you're risking. You have to recognize that this comes with a danger, because the truth of the matter is there are many attractive things in this world. And it could be that they'll find something else and think that that's attractive, right? All the gzeros, all the rabbinic decrees that we have regarding bishul akum, not eating food that was cooked by someone who isn't Jewish, not having wine with them, and all those things are all predicated on the recognition that if you get to know them, you find out they're nice people too, they're good people too, and if your commitment isn't that strong to following this path, then you can just as easily marry them and follow some other path. You know, those rules are made by people who recognize the risk and are trying to create a fence which will succeed sometimes and not succeed other times. But that's the issue, and that's what this midrash is talking about. Is you want to know how it is that Moshe's grandson ends up worshiping Avodah Zarah? The answer is because there was an exposure to it within the family. And it proved destructive. That's what this midrash is trying to tell you happens with Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe / ben Moshe. So what we have then are four different potential explanations for how this happened. You have the Gemara of Abasra that says it was economic need. You have the question of, was his father at Matan Torah, at the giving of the Torah? You have the possibility that that it's actually intentional that his father doesn't continue as his grandfather did. Moshe's kids do not, like Aaron's kids, inherit his position, right? Moshe's kids do not inherit the position. Torah is not an inheritance, and this then continues that shift. Or this idea that actually the family had idolatry introduced because Yisrael wants them to learn to be seekers of truth, and it backfired. At the end of the day, I can't say one over another in terms of explaining this. I happen to like the Gemara Nedarim, the Gemara that talks about not having dynasties of Talmidei Chachamim. I think that it may really be as simple as that. But I think that the reason why Tanakh, on the one hand, protects Moshe by not quite labeling the name and by putting it at the end of the story, but on the other hand, gives you this hint to pick up on, is because these are lessons we need to learn. This isn't just an academic story. This isn't just something that happened in Moshe's family. But it's a lesson that we need to learn, whichever way we approach it, in terms of what can happen and what did happen in Moshe's line. So that concludes the story of Pesel Micha, Micha's idol. It's what happens when there's no leadership, right? In Melech Bisrael, we repeated that multiple times. It's the growth of either idolatry or syncretism among the Jews when we live among the Canaanites. It's we become like them, right? The tribe of Dan, with its greed, they raid those people who are living up north in Laish or Leshem, as well as the greed of the Levi, right, who is just, you know, looking for an opportunity. He left Yehuda, he went here because they were willing to feed him and give him a change of clothing. Then Dan says to him, why would you stick with one place? You could have a much bigger kehila. You could have this whole the whole shevet. And the fact that we have no outside enemy here. This isn't about everything that we saw until this point, where it's the Plishtim, it's the Midyanim, it's the Moavim, it's Amon, it's somebody who's coming to attack us. This is us harming ourselves. Which, I'm going to start the recorder again for the next